Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to another episode in season two for Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group and proud host of VFE. Today's guest is just an absolute honor to have her on. She is, yes, she is one of the design thinking AI experts, not just here domestically, but internationally as well. It was roughly about, I would say, what, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? It's about 3 years ago, right? We just started talking and I'm like, man, Saba is like, well, who is she? So I had to ask multiple people and they're like, oh, no, she is the queen of design thinking. She's the queen of AI. And then the more I just started to engage with Saba, with our conversations, seeing her, whether it be in California, and then most recently, she brought the weather with her to New York City at EdTech Week. It was so good to see her. And then finally, I'm like, EdTech Week, I'm like, Saba, I got to get you on my podcast. She's like, of course, I would love to. And finally, VFE, we got her. So it is so good and an absolute honor to have Dr. Saba Kidwai out of the design schools, her own organization, to my listeners and to my viewers. If you have not, or if you don't know Dr. Kidwai, please just go into her work, unwrap it, and you will learn a ton. You want to talk about a master's class? Yes, we're about to have one here on VFE. So Dr. Kidwai, Saba, how are you? So good to see you. You didn't bring the weather today. It is actually 36 degrees over here. But yes, cold. But so good to see you, my friend. How are you?
Oh my God, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm doing well. And I also found our first conversation to be extremely memorable. I was so impressed by your, I'm always just really impressed by people. And I love when we could make like connections between themes, and you were a master at that interconnection between so many different things. So thank you for having me. I'm excited to chat with you today.
Saba, the episode ends right now. I got my marketing line from you. Now I'll be able to ask my marketing team to take all of the nice little sentiments that I get and just end it. No, I'm just playing. Saba, it means so much coming from you because I respect your work holistically, the impact that you're having on practitioners, the impact that you're having on leaders, but more importantly, really unpacking the necessary transformation, the necessary redesign that needs to occur in education. And you are a leading voice in our country. So let's use this as a master's class, but for us, it's a straight geek out session. So, but Dr. Kidwai, first question, right? I know your work personally. A lot of my listeners and viewers, they know your work. But when leaders, educational stakeholders, and innovation agents within the ecosystem engage in a session with you, whether it be around design thinking, whether it be around strategically integrating AI into the organizational elements, or just even into our operating model ourselves, what change look like? What song describes your work for impact in the AC stage of education?
Oh my gosh. Okay. So the first one that comes to mind is, and honestly, this is like my power song as well. It's Unstoppable by Sia, where, you know, she goes like, I'm a Porsche with no brakes, like unstoppable. Like I can do basically, you know, I'm so powerful. Like I can do anything today. And that's, I think, why I love design thinking so much, because being able to return that feeling of agency and that feeling of being unstoppable to people, I think that's the gift that I hope to be able to give others. Like you are unstoppable. You can do anything you want if you have the right exercises, frameworks, practices, and mindset, and, you know, being able to fuel you as you go on your way.
Absolutely. Thank you, Saba. Unstoppable. Yes, you are, right? When I think about...
We all are.
But I mean, Dr. Kidwai, so correct, right? Correctly stated. When you think of design thinking, I always like to reference that first element of design thinking, right? Empathy. And that is right there, that collection or that coalition around developing the work that is unstoppable. But I loved how you scaffolded, right? Frameworks to exercise, to your mindset, right? Those different exercises to be able to get them in that mindset so that now that learning becomes into practice, or that theoretical underpinning around those concepts of design thinking is articulated within the work. And I think that is the most essential pillar that we have to really focus on. But if we continuously to build that collective shared capability, capacity around what this work looked like for the vision, or to meet the vision demands, you're right, we are all going to be unstoppable. But I want to move on nicely into the segue, right, Dr. Kidwai, around design thinking and agency, referencing some key points from your first answer. But when I think about this, right, design thinking in the context of organizational and classroom reimagination, right, before in the BC stage of education, before COVID, that was considered a non-traditional approach. Now, it takes a pandemic to be able to really realize what this work looked like in the educational context, right? So it's considered a necessity to transform systems to be in alignment with the current and the future forecast demands to prepare our students for Delta 2030. Now, in your own words, as a national expert with design thinking and its core principles, how do we leverage this approach to address complex challenges, to systematize new opportunities in learning organizations holistically?
I've just got all the answers, you know.
The master's class 501, everybody.
You know what's so interesting? So much of what drives my work is this. If I had to sum it up in one line, it's this quote from William Gibson, where he says, "The future is here. It just isn't evenly distributed." And I think as time goes on, things that we consider to be non-traditional or things that we consider to be unique approaches are actually luxuries for some that are not accessible to everyone else. And so when I think back to like 2007, I often share how, you know, when I graduated in 2007, I was the most cookie cutter person you could have ever imagined. Like I had 2008 when the recession hit, you know, it was layoff notices for me for the next 5 years. Like I was so confused about how to adapt. But when now I look back at that time and I think, wow, well, Steve Jobs launched the iPhone in 2007. Like people were creating Airbnb, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. Like how was that happening? How did those people know? And I didn't. And you realize that entrepreneurship or being able to have access to those opportunities was non-traditional for school, but a luxury that allowed others to have access to certain opportunities that people like me and many others didn't. And so I really see design thinking practices in the same way, in that yesterday it was a luxury and now today it's a necessity. And we're seeing it so much with AI. You know, it's been truly, you know, it's been disappointing really to see where we're at in education with such a powerful technology that really has the ability to be able to fill in so many of the gaps for us. But we have people, most people don't even know where to begin. And when they do begin, we're seeing more like that same technology first approach. Let me show you the top 5 apps to use and things like that. And one of the reasons we will encourage people so much to first, like, don't even think about the technology right now. Like just first and foremost, what are your people struggling with?
Yeah.
How are your people feeling? What do your people want to see in your organization? What do you want to see in your organization that is not being realized? And what are those barriers that are standing in your way? And this is important twofold. Number one, it's really the only way to get people to take ownership in change and to have agency and to actually be excited and motivated about what's possible. But number two, our entire professional development model, and this is specific to education, of like, we're going to do the summer training, or we're going to do 4 sessions a year, or this idea that we're waiting for somebody else to teach us is not going to work anymore. And the only way people are going to be independent learners and be motivated to do that, which is very ironic that we have to even say, given that our number one goal is to help cultivate and nurture lifelong learners, but the only way you're going to get people invested in that strategy, invested in their own learning, is if they feel a motivation for something that is going to solve a problem for them. It has to be so uniquely personal, and the element then has to be able to be tied to your larger vision if we're going to see success moving forward. Otherwise, I'm truly scared for people that, you know, are like, oh, well, we'll just wait. We'll just see what happens. Or, you know, yeah, we'll do the AI training next summer for all our teachers. Like, the model just will not support the speed and scale of change that we see. And design thinking is not only just about, you know, let's lean into your problems, your challenges, your frustrations, but also your hopes and dreams. It's also what is just step one. Because that's another big challenge we see. We try to overhaul everything all in one go, and it breaks. We saw that, I think, just with GPTs, which we can talk about a little bit later. But like, we saw so many people just rush to try to make things public instead of trying to personalize. Well, what does this mean for me? Like, how does this work for me? Before thinking about other kind of, you know, ripple effects that you could potentially then have once you have fine-tuned, tested, iterated, and gotten feedback on what you're working on.
Absolutely. And Dr. Kidwai, I want to go back to your original comment, right? 2007, and it kind of takes education a while to actually catch up, or historically based off of quantitative measures that we've seen comparative to the economic market, we haven't caught up, right? Giving you that prime example, I just gave a keynote a couple weeks back in New Jersey. And what I talked about was the two-part phenomenon of before COVID with AI and education, and before COVID, the economic market with AI. And education was the novelty of it, right? Very limited understanding, negative connotations around AI in the education model. But when we talk about it in the economic market, customer service was using it, right? We had logistics that were using it. Medical profession was using it. We saw eBay, Netflix, Airbnb, even to the point of eBay, right? We saw that happening. And even in 1956, John McCarthy gave a very concise and coherent definition of what artificial intelligence was, 1956. So if we're just, you know, really assimilating or accelerating to adopt principles of design thinking, adopt principles of AI, we're still behind, right? And you stated it so eloquently as well, where it's just this level of application adoption. And we're going to get into that, where we're looking at AI solutions just in, I like to say, this ad hoc form in lieu of really looking at it from a broad organizational design sense. I like to say whole systems transformation that is reauthored by AI and emergent technologies. But hopes and dreams, ideation, and moreover, the mega theme I got from your response was agency and empathy, right? That agency and empathy working together. But Dr. Kidwai, again, right? The goal in education is to memorialize equity and excellence. You spoke about it around the gaps, right? With DT and how DT design thinking can be able to close those gaps at an accelerated rate. But we have to look at this in creative ways using design and agile principles. And an evolving lever since the pandemic, what we've seen is elevating AI into the educational model. We've talked about it on a very surface level. Now I really want to go deep into this, right? It's been presented with minimal guidance for implementation. It's kind of, hey, we got these great tools. Let's put it in this classroom. Let's put a different tool. So when we talk about incongruence, when we talk about coherence, right, that's where now we can see a fundamental design gap. But in a concrete, contextualized form, Dr. Kidwai, how do we root equity in our learning organizations and schools by underscoring AI as a systems level strategy?
Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the hardest things for people, because it's the irony of watching the systems that are designed to protect people fall apart at a time and have very little autonomy and authority over global affairs, while also trying to design and put trust in these international or even national entities to, again, protect people, is a conversation I don't think we're having enough. It truly is, I think, when people look back on this time, going to be one of the biggest dichotomies between, like, wow, like, on this side, you have those same institutions crumbling. On this side, you're trying to use those institutions to move you forward. Yet nobody is analyzing or asking, why do we have these discrepancies? And why are these international organizations not protecting people in the way that they are designed to be able to, you know, come through in moments of need? And so I think even being able to put your hopes in or your confidence in, let's just, you know, let's not even do international right now, let's just say a national policy, let's just be really specific to the United States, is going to be so challenging because it contradicts so many of the core values that, while they might not be necessarily the values that we believe in, they are the values that operate our economic system. So, for example, we are not a society that believes in necessarily, like we're a society that still struggles to give people access to college. We're a society that still struggles to give, like, we still wonder whether everybody should have access to healthcare. Very, very, very basic human needs are not things that we traditionally believe in holistically as a society. And so when you have those kinds of gaps that are present, but now you're looking at another sort of like this outside AI entity coming in, it's very challenging then to be able to align those different pieces together. And so I think within that is both an opportunity and a challenge. The challenge is you as a leader are looking to guidance when there is none, because you are also trying to, like, figure out what to do and how to put the pieces together. But one of the reasons I think design thinking can be so helpful is it is precisely designed for those ambiguous moments where there are no answers. You know, I always say, when you look back at the, you know, so I do this activity with people where we map out the technology that's evolved over the last two decades. And you see all the things, all the way from Google to email, to social media, to iPhones, to, you know, all the things we have now. And then we map the research alongside those emerging technologies. And one of the most significant papers came out in 2013 called Dancing with Robots. And this is, remember, 10 years ago. It's so hard for me to even wrap my head around that number. But 10 years ago, we had people telling us, researchers telging us, this was Levy and Murnane, telling us there are only two things that are going to matter in a world with AI. Being able to solve a complex problem, right? A problem to which there's no answer. And AI in education has no answer. And that answer is also going to look different for everyone. But number two, being able to engage in complex communication. You want it to look this way. I want it to look this way. Five people here want something different. How are we going to reach consensus and have dialogue and debate that's going to advance our societies? We fail miserably, unfortunately, in both areas. And those are the two most unique human skills. And they're the ones we need the most. And so one of the things that I love about design thinking is that it can give you the, I say it's like the guardrails to hold on to as you are walking into what could be a conversation that you have no idea what direction it's going to go in. It allows you to control, which sounds so contradictory, right? Because we're trying to create and design. But it is that very control, it is that very structure of the exercises and the frameworks that allow you to safely have dialogue and discussion that could otherwise go off the rails. And you completely, very quickly can lose control of those types of conversations, which is why I think many are even hesitant to open that door. And so when you use those practices, when you use those frameworks, we visualize ideas, we know when to say things out loud, we know when to write things down, we know when to have dialogue and debate, and we know when to just, you know, note and vote and just be able to, like, mark our ideas around different things to really narrow things down. So there are a lot of frameworks and practices that can help us move in that direction. But to your question earlier, I think I don't know that we're going to, at least I personally don't have confidence in a national policy. And I think one of the things I was also really disappointed in, and, you know, just given, again, some of the things that we've seen over the last couple of years, is I love how all of a sudden we want to be open to immigration when it suits us, and we want to close the doors on people when it doesn't suit us. And I think Biden's request to loosen immigration policies, because the other impact of that is, why do you have no national talent in AI? Why does it have to be a part of your policy that we have to go and seek people from the outside? What are we doing to strengthen our people from within? What are we investing in our own education systems to make sure that our students are going to college? Because you got to, you know, you need to, like, you know, have access to these opportunities to things. if you're going to go that deep into research and AI science and all these other pieces, sure, there's other pathways where you don't have to, but why is that not a choice that every single kid in this country gets to make for themselves? So I, for one, am not super optimistic about a national policy because I think there's very hard conversations that need to be had if you want to be able to get to a place where we can have that. And I don't know that society is ready, to be honest, to have those conversations.
Yeah. And Dr. Kidwai, wow, because you brought up a great point about national policy. Well, I concur with you 100% where we have to be able to build our own social capital around AI. And you you stated it where there's just so many variances with regards to the definition of AI and what it will look like from a concretized standpoint. But I want to touch upon two things. One will be, or the second will be a sub question just for level setting with my listeners. But the national policy, I want to underscore what you stated, that because education has historically been so slow with adaptation or adoption holistically of policies or even new governance practices, I believe that we won't be able to come to a consensus around a national policy. I think the best that we might do is develop national guidelines with a level of flexibility within the language, and then also the evolution of AI being so fast, I think that the policy would be outdated within 20 minutes, right? But I want to engage in something, two critical points that you highlighted. Very difficult for us to solve complex problems. Yes, I always reference Daniel Kahneman's work around systems one thinking versus systems two thinking. And we revert so much on the cognitive ease as opposed to that cognitive stretching point that Kahneman always talk about. How are we able to shift some of the dynamics to systems two thinking in lieu of just linear systems one thinking? But you touched upon it, where engaging in complex conversations and there are immense variances among the individuals or stakeholders that are involved, bringing their own experience and bringing their own understanding of whether it be theory or empirical studies. One of my professors at Harvard that I had, Michael Tushman, love Michael, hope all is well, Professor Tushman, he always stated that the hardest level within an organization or even within a broad industry to achieve is not the transformation or redesign of the hardware, i.e. the architectures, the elements, the structures, and the systems, but it's more in the lines of achieving that universal shared mental model, the software, everybody getting to think in the same direction, speaking the same language, common language of instruction, common lexicon around AI. That is the hardest to achieve, and you touched upon it. But Dr. Kidwai, just as a follow-up question or sub-question, just for level-setting purposes, right? You and I, we've been referencing design thinking, DT, and in abbreviation, right? But for my listeners, and thank you. I listened to the feedback, everybody. All right, we're going to unpack it even more. Dr. Kidwai, can you go over, just for level-setting with my listeners, the elements of design thinking and in a very short, albeit abstract notion of what those elements mean?
Absolutely. I would say if it was like one sentence, design thinking is a method and a mindset for being able to either solve problems or discover new opportunities. And it's important to have that method and mindset. So if we start with the method, it's, you know, like you shared earlier, we really begin with the empathy phase, where we, before we come up with any solution, before we decide what we're going to do for our strategy or implementation or creation plan, we are talking to people. We are observing what's happening. And the reason for that is, you know, that empathy lens challenges a lot of what you think should happen and allows you to really understand what needs to happen. And that gap that's in between can be the difference between having a successful strategy or an unsuccessful and unsustainable one. And then from there, once you've kind of identified like, wow, this is really the problem we need to solve, it's not about creating this long overarching plan with huge implementation. It's about first figuring out what is step one going to be that we can put out into the world or into our organization that we can test. to see, are we on the right track? And it's truly those bite-sized steps that we take that allow us to constantly be doing those check-ins. Okay, I need to test this. Okay, let's go back with this little part here didn't work. Let's refine this. Okay, let's keep going. And you don't even realize when that goes from being something really methodical, really step-by-step that you're following in a really structured way, to just becoming a natural part of how you think, how you work, and how you operate. It's really hard to even know when that defining moment is for you, but it happens to everyone. And the one thing I would say, just, you know, going on what we were talking about, is when there are no guidelines, that level of disruption is your ultimate opportunity for creation, because no one has answers. So guess what? The person who comes up with those answers is going to be the one that people look for. And there's a positive and negative in that, because your answers could be great and could really help, but they could also not be so great. But because people have no other thing to turn to, that will naturally kind of become the default. And so every single community has an opportunity to be like, what do we want to do in this moment? What do we want to advocate for? And what is that going to look like for us? Because no one's really telling us what it should look like.
You're right. Thank you, Dr. Kidwai. And I just wanted to clarify, for my listeners, because obviously one thing I wanted to do was I use this as an asynchronous professional learning platform, self-directed learning heterodoxy. And I want them to replay this back, right? Replay this episode back, and then to be able to have the basic conceptual constructs of what design thinking is and how they're able to create opportunity grounded or rooted in creativity. But based off of your work, Dr. Kidwai, right, both nationally and internationally, we've seen this explosion of AI tools. If I hear ChatGPT one more time, right, I always say this, Dr. Kidwai, from within the ecosystem, for every time that I hear ChatGPT, got to put a dollar in the hat, right? And I tell you, I will be a very, very, very rich man right now, even in a matter of 7 days, right, when we talk about that. But based off of your work nationally and internationally, what future trends as well as signals should we be paying attention to with regards to AI? And also, too, as a second part of this question is, which strategies from a reverse engineering perspective, and to my audience, reverse engineering specifically meaning you have the whole, it goes from whole to part, part to whole. You're reconstructing or you're deconstructing to reconstruct a new model. So from a reverse engineering standpoint, Dr. Kidwai, should we implement AI for success in the business model of education, or how do we do that from that lens?
You know, I would say right now, there's no real answer for like, this is what you should do exactly, and this is how you should roll it out, and this is how it can look like. There are, however, though, a lot of things to consider. What you call signals, right? I love Jane McGonigal in her book, Imaginable, where she talks about like signals of change. And when you look back, those signals seem so obvious. And it can feel like you don't know what they are, but they're actually not that hard to begin to spot if you start paying attention. So I always say, I feel like for a lot of us, one of the reasons AI is so hard to wrap your head around is because a lot of people, like we talk a lot about the shift the internet made, we don't talk enough about the shift mobility brought. When the idea of what iPhones and mobility in general allowed for is something that really only a fraction of the population took advantage of. What it means to actually build a business and live wherever you want and be able to make more money than you would in a 9-to-5 is something most people still cannot even wrap their heads around, let alone actually go out and build it and create it for themselves. Now, that same large population wishes they knew how. Right? It is the dream for people, I think, for so many to be able to leave your 9-to-5. And I think if you're, and you know, it also got me thinking how like internet still today isn't even accessible to everyone.
Right.
It's still, there's a huge equity gap, even just in that space right there. So now you think internet isn't even something that most people have access to, let alone how to build on top of it, right? Then you think about mobility and the shift that iPhone brought about. And you think about how many people don't know how to build on top of it and don't have access to those, like, you know, actually making it meaningful now you put AI in the mix. And so one of the things you begin to see is how that opportunity gap is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, simply because we don't understand how to leverage these technologies for personal, professional, and academic use. Sure, we can scroll. Sure, we can write a poem on ChatGPT. But can we create economic value for ourselves out of these technologies to design a life that's different than what we had before? If you truly want to escape that industrial model, it requires new structures and new ways of looking at things. We are struggling today to even understand online school. We're struggling to, forget school. People can't even figure out a hybrid workplace, right? People want everyone back in the office. And it's because mobility is not a mindset that we have. And so that's, to me, the biggest gap that I see. And I always tell people, if you can understand mobility, you'll be able to understand so many areas of how AI actually does play a really, really significant role. However, if you're in a really traditional environment, I can see why you don't think it would be as valuable to you, because you're not able to see the possibilities of outside of that traditional model that you've been living in for so long. So being able to look at examples of other things that are happening in other industries, what are people doing? What are people building? How are people creating things? And I think one of the biggest opportunities, I think, for so many people is so many people have ideas. They want to start something. They want to do something. It may or may not have that economic value that's going to take you out of what you're currently in into something different. But I find a lot of people have ideas and really struggle to execute. And I'm one of them. You know, I had so many things I wanted to build, but I knew I would need to hire so many people before I could get there. And one of them was really my online course. Right? There's a lot of moving pieces. Like, building the course is easy, but the email funnels, the sales, the marketing strategies, all those different pieces require you to really hire out. And what AI was able to do for me was unimaginable. Like, I truly still till this day, I'm shocked that I'm able to get the kind of results from it that I am by just putting in a few prompts that would have cost a good couple hundred dollars, $1,000 to go and hire for. But why do I have that mindset? Because I'm looking for more mobility in my life. I'm looking for passive income in my life. I'm looking for other economic opportunities. So I can see how AI is not taking anything from me. It's helping accelerate what my goals are. So that's a really big thing, is really being able to identify, what do you actually want? What kind of life do you want? What do you see happening around you that you wish you could have that you don't have? And what does that pathway to that look like? You know, whatever that may be for you. And I think on a personal level, being able to do that will really help automatically unlock a lot of the professional. And then from a reverse engineering standpoint, I think many of the skills and things that we need are in front of us, right? Like, we know that, you know, we used to always talk about, we don't know what jobs kids tomorrow are going to have. Forget jobs. We don't even know what the world is going to look like. It's not even humans you're competing against anymore. It's like humans and AI. Like, the world is just completely it's, you know, a free for all. Whatever you think it could be, it quite possibly could. And in such an ambiguous space, the only thing you can do is build your skill set one step. You need to be lockstep and key with this technology, not waiting to see what everyone else is doing before you decide to go in and learn. Because, you know, it's so interesting. You know what you say about ChatGPT and how many people are talking about it? It went from 100 million users in 2 months to, at the keynote, you know, last week, they shared how they had 100 million weekly users.
Wow. And
of those 100 million weekly users, or maybe it's monthly users, whatever, weekly or monthly, a significant number, only 1% subscribe and use GPT-4.
Wow.
Only 1%. And so what I tell people is, and like I tell this day, just the last week, I was with a group of leaders who was using 4. Maybe one hand goes up, maybe. And I tell people, if you're using the free version, it's like you're playing with an iPod and you're designing an entire strategy for the future around an iPod. And tomorrow, everyone's walking in with a Mac.
Wow.
Or you're spending so much time thinking, designing, and talking about what is already obsolete.
Right.
Because the actual technology is so different. But if you are somebody, like I think back, I really wonder about that person now who all of a sudden gets 4 today. You have a huge learning curve. You know, I mean, GPT just came out last week. And if your learning curve is not moving lockstep and key with the technology, it's going to be really hard, I think, for that adjustment. to take place, because tomorrow, I think we're going to see enterprise versions much more quicker than we probably imagine. And when you do, that's everyone walking with a MacBook. But you spent all your time just playing with an iPod, building a strategy around that. And I think that is going to, I think in 2024, that's the big challenge we're going to see.
Absolutely. Well stated, Dr. Kinwai. Well stated, specifically, you know, the advanced levels of sophistication with the language models, prompt engineering that we're engaging in. And fascinating data point, right? That you state only 1% is using the second iteration of ChatGPT. So going back to the BC stage of education, right, where education had this, I like to say, resistance to assimilate even to the novel levels of AI in the before stage where our economic market was already transitioning and leveling artificial intelligence into the economy. But one thing, your overall answer, it goes back to another professor I had, Kareem Makani. He is the author of Compete in the Age of AI, right? And fascinating book, fascinating course that I had him with. But his quote resonates with me. AI won't replace humans. AI with humans will replace humans without AI. And that's essentially what you're talking about with your answer with regards to this level of mobility. And mobility as a mindset, I think that's going to be a radical and fundamental paradigm shift that's going to be underscored with immense paradoxes for an individual if mobility becomes a mindset. But listen, to my listeners, Dr. Kinwai is 20 years ahead of the game. So listen, download ChatGPT 4.0 and make sure you have a mindset that is undergirded with mobility. But I want to elaborate on something that you stated. And this is a question I keep asking because I have this intuition that it might become an equity gap or an equity challenge that we are going to face. And that is exactly opportunity and access for all, and to use AI a part of this new economic value. But just like what we see with racial equity, gender equity, all of the inequities and disparities that we feel in education, I believe that, and again, this is just a forecast, Dr. Kinwai, that AI is going to become the new equity or disparity amongst historically excluded groups, speaking specifically just in context, gender and racial equity of what we've been fighting for in education, even in the economy for so long. Do you forecast this as a future issue that now we're going to have to add another level of equity, which is going to be created by AI and these new emerging technologies?
Yeah. So I would say twofold. Absolutely, yes. But also, this is what happens when you're not lockstep and key with emerging technologies and you're not keeping pace with the system. So another article that we have on that timeline that we share that maps, you know, technology to research is 2001, Paul Atwell, right? In 2001. So now, not 10 years ago, 20 years ago, we had people telling us, look, you don't just have a digital divide, you've got a digital use divide, where some people get access to technology to solve problems. And that's why in 2007, you had people like building Facebook, you had people building Apple, you had people doing these things, and people like me who didn't have that access to those kinds of experiences, struggling to keep up and keep pace and adapt to what was going on, because you don't even know the first thing about it. I didn't own an iPhone at that time, like, you know, even up until like, you know, a couple of years after. So that, again, I think it's so important. I remind people of this often, because not to say that you shouldn't be let off the hook, but because we have to reflect on the past if we're going to do something differently in our present. And I think when people don't reflect on the past, that's when you are more reactive. And that's when you don't realize, like, I have, like, you know, after we show that timeline, we ask people, like, what are the unintended consequences of not designing schools in a world that's rapidly changing? And we say unintended, you know, very intentionally, because it's not like we chose to do this to people. It's not like we wanted to do this. But when we don't keep pace, there are consequences for us that seeing the speed and scale of not if technology is also matching the speed and scale of consequences. And so, you know, it's 2016, like again, almost 10 years ago, Stanford's graduate school history education group did a study on information literacy and how people were able to just, you know, navigate online information and just information literacy, media literacy on the internet. And in their report and in their write-up, they, in 2016, they said, if, you know, children of the future is very ill-informed. Because they had 80% of high school students that couldn't tell whether a source, when didn't even check to see if a source was valid. Like, was this real or was this not real, you know? And now today, you've got deepfake technology proliferating, and it's going to get even worse. I feel like we haven't even seen, like, the bits and pieces that are going to come yet. But they said their data found, like, their, like, conclusion from their study was that the future is bleak, dismal, and a threat to democracy. Because these very basic information and literacy skills are like essential to, like, you know, interrogate these technologies that we're seeing now. And so those are like some of the challenges like you see from that lens. But the one, again, I go back to though, the design thinking is that if you're constantly waiting for somebody else to give you something, you're going to be waiting a very long time. And I would love to see more people really like are big education organizations, really. And I imagine this is coming because I imagine this is happening, but we have to get better at advocating for our kids and for our teachers. I think this is a real moment, you know, for education, like for a profession that's been so neglected, to literally be like, we are like your ultimate key in being able to unlock a society that knows how to operate in this way. But if we're not going to give our educators and our schools access to these technologies in advance, like we give them to influencers, we give them to all these other people, if we're not going to give this to our schools, how in the world do we expect our next generation to be prepared? And that is the equity issue of our time, because like I just shared, it's in the last few months, there's a huge gap between that free version and that paid version. And if you don't even know what the paid version is, you can't even begin to think about what's possible for you, let alone how to operationalize.
Absolutely. Well stated, Dr. Kidwai. And just for my listeners, Dr. Kidwai, can you reference Paul Atwal's work and then the 2016 report from Stanford University so that my listeners will be able to obtain that through their own independent research?
Yeah. Oh, you want me to send you a link to it?
Oh, no. If you could just say it right now.
So it's 2001 Paul Atwal. I want to say, just Google Paul Atwal digital use divide, and you'll see that's 2001. And then the second one is going to be 2016 Stanford History Education Group. Just put like media literacy or something like that will come up.
Thank you. Thank you. Because my listeners like the geek out like me, Dr. Kidwai.
I get the
amount of emails that I get, Saba, just to say, hey, you know, on that episode, what was the research that they were referencing, or what was the white paper that they were referencing? So just want to put it in context so that they'll be able to do their own independent research. And you talked about something, right, that is very important and critical, essential information literacy skills. And I think that that's one of the grounded, rooted skills that our students, specifically Generation Z, Generation Y, I'm sorry, Generation Z and Generation Alpha are going to need. But advocating for our teachers and our students. Yes. And I think that we have to be able to double down on that advocacy in the AC stage of education with the multiple competing variables that we're seeing in education, even to the level of how we're able to unwrap and address mental health, you know, social emotional wellness. For our students. But we talked about it with AI with regards to the specific inequities that we are potentially or forecasted to see. But also, if you can just elaborate, how do we avoid pitfalls around compromised data ethics, around data exploitation and an over-reliance of technology? Moreover, Dr. Kidwai, let's be honest, when you and I enter rooms around psychometricians, data scientists, around statisticians who are developing these models and these algorithms for a high degree of F1 accuracy, they don't look like us, Dr. Kidwai. You and I will go in there, high five, be like, hey, we're the only ones in here. And we can speak for that because this is objectively stating the data because we've been in those rooms, right? And when we talk about algorithms that are free of bias, I'm going to add that in there. How do we avoid these pitfalls?
Yeah. I want to go back to your mental health one for a really quick second.
Yeah, please do.
Prime example of why design thinking matters so much. So let me state it properly this time, but the Center for Democracy and Technology just did a survey asking how students were using ChatGPT. That was like one of the questions, or just generative AI. I don't know what the exact question is. Mm-hmm. But the findings were that at a time when we are so fixated on cheating and plagiarism, then the main way in which students are actually using these AI technologies is for support with mental health. A lot of the students were using it for depression and anxiety. They were using it to figure out how to get solutions to conflicts with friends and conflicts with family. Friends ranked higher than family. Family was last, but it was my own anxiety and mental health, conflicts with my friends, and conflicts with my family. And one of the things, like, you know, there's like that book, like Lies My Teacher Told Me. I have this thing we have, like, lies we tell teachers. Like, that idea that you are somehow invincible because as a teacher you build relationships is probably one of the biggest lies we're telling people that is going to make them obsolete. And I feel like as someone who graduated as a teacher really unprepared, I really don't like if I think back to myself, if I was a new teacher, or if I was, you know, doing something like that now, and somebody gave me this like reassurance, but then 3 years from now, it turned out to be completely untrue, you just completely wasted 3 years of my opportunity to learn, to grow, and to figure things out. And I want to really, it's like one of my biggest goals is to make sure, I always say, in the worst case scenario, even if AI doesn't take your job, you just became 1,000 times better at what you do. You just, your skill set just up-leveled 1,000 times. Because even when we use that quote, like, oh, as long as you use AI, you won't be replaced, the one big piece that's missing from that entire equation is your income and your quality and your standard of living. Because sure, you may have a job, but imagine tomorrow as a teacher, if you're only needed for 60% of your job and you only get 60% of your pay, what does that mean for you? And so what do you need to do to make sure you're 150% and the AI is always at its, because you better believe the AI is going to bring its A game. It may have its bias, it may have its everything, but you better believe it's going to bring its A game. And the more we see, just what we see in the last year is any sign or signal for what's to come, it's, you need to be 150% at what you do, but that doesn't mean you work 150%. It means I work maybe 30% at a 150% level. And those people who are able to master that, those are the people who can safely say, okay, I think we're going to be okay. We're going to have to keep like lockstep and key, but we're going to be okay. So I really want to make sure people realize not to trust everything they hear and to really always be thinking about how you're up-leveling your own skill set. And so to answer your question then about data, it's such a, this one is so, these questions are so hard. At least for me, because I so much history and like politics and like all these, they're so intertwined. And if I was to say anything, I'd say this. One of the hardest things, and this goes back to that complex communication, we are going to see things become more and more and more intertwined. It is going to be impossible to have a conversation. Even now when I walk into a space, even I'm hesitant, but it is soon going to be impossible to have a conversation about the future of AI without being able to integrate politics, without being able to integrate all these other very difficult conversations that we like to tiptoe around. And is also, I think, unfair for education to bear that burden. They shouldn't. Your schools should not have to be the centers of solving every single challenge in the world with no support. And I think for those of us who are outside of schools, looking for how we advocate, the schools not have to be the ones to take on that responsibility alone, is going to be really hard. Like, I'll tell you right now, like, just in California in 2025, all schools are supposed to have ethnic studies. And, you know, you would not think that would be that big of a deal given how diverse the state is. Right. It's a nightmare for a school to navigate. And why should a superintendent have to be at the mercy of their board and their own political opinions instead of being able to look out for the best interests of all kids and focus on what they need to be doing to support everyone in their organization? And so there's a lot of accountability at different levels. So when we talk even about things like data and whatnot, like, as a society, we don't really have, I mean, honestly, we're so like lucky to have Apple that put in some of the restrictions that they did so that Facebook couldn't sit and just eat away all our data. And that's another thing when you think about signals, you think about how, you know, there's so many technologies that we use where we think it's so harmless. Oh, I'm just uploading a photo. Oh, like we're all doing this trending reel in the same way. And then you begin to understand algorithms, and then you begin to understand how they're trained. And the more alike these things are, the easier it is for that algorithm to categorize everyone up. And so there's so many from a societal level, so many things that technology companies are not held accountable for. Right. That it's so funny. Even you mentioned, you know, I think it was you earlier, you mentioned Grok and, you know, Elon Musk and some of these new ones. It's so funny. Just a few months ago, all of them were talking about how we need to have restrictions and, you know, we need to like not be like competing and we need to be like careful. And now here you are, like, you can tell OpenAI, this is another really big important thing for people to know. If you listen to any interview with anyone from OpenAI, it is so, they're like a kid who has to keep a secret. And that's literally the vibe you get, you know, and you can so easily tell they have so much. And if you listen carefully to what they're saying, we're giving this to you as a gift. We're releasing this as a gift to you so that you can figure things out and not be super overwhelmed when this comes about. It is so obvious from listening to them. That is the number one thing you hear. So I really encourage people to, like, there's a lot of things that are out of our control, that not that we shouldn't focus on them, but the more you focus on yourself and the more you focus on understanding the technologies, the better positioned you'll be to have conversations around data ethics, around privacy, and around all these things, because the government doesn't understand the technology and clearly cannot even regulate these tech companies. And also that's where capitalism comes into play as well, right? Like it's going to be very hard in a lot of ways. This is not something a school alone can fix and solve and create every answer for. The only thing you can really do is have values that are constantly being echoed throughout every single thing you do to create a culture around those values that, sure, some people may not all abide by, but that I don't know what to tell people other than values. Like, I really don't. And I always say, like, rules are meant to be broken. So you can put 1,000 rules in place, rules are meant to be broken. But when we believe in values, we uphold them. You know, it's how relationships are truly built are through values, not rules, right? Like, good luck building a relationship around rules, you know? but values, we feel bad, right? We don't want to disappoint. But there's a deeper human emotion, I think, with values. But it's data ethics. All of these are really, really complex conversations and ones that we have to hold a lot of different groups of people accountable for.
Absolutely. Well stated, Saba. Well stated. Specifically when you got to the point, I'm just referencing my notes, around the algorithmic design, right? And supervised algorithms, with the more data that is collected, the stronger the intelligence is becoming. And I love how you characterize it when you hear somebody from OpenAI, because it's so true. It's like, wait, you only give it a piece of the pie when you got the whole pie. And within that piece, or I should say the alignment with the data sets that they're releasing, we should be developing these algorithms to really solve economic and equity issues. But it's more in the lines how we put these regulatory mandates to hold tech companies accountable for that. It's going to be very interesting as we're seeing the next iteration of AI. We're talking AI and education, but let's be real. We're already at the next stage of generative AI, where now prompt engineering and levels of different data engineering and wrangling processes are turning into, I like to say, these advanced front-end experiences, but the back end of it is so complex and intricate and so far advanced that I think that education needs to have this urgency acceleration, albeit strategic and pragmatic. I know that's a great dichotomy, will bring immense cognitive dissonance to people, but it goes back to what you stated at the outset. We can't look at answers in this binary way. So, Dr. Kidwai, last question. Man, Saba, you made it. You made it through being, you got me on the hot seat, making sure I'm okay, asking the national expert around DT, design thinking, AI, all the necessary questions so my listeners will be able to take back on the critical and core content from our conversation into their practices around the design thinking of testing on these new elements within their learning organizations. But I always say this from season one, now it's season two, Dr. Kid Y. People take this question, right? And I try to limit them to three words, but they use the level of design thinking, right? They create their own opportunities to really answer the question. So it's really only meant to be three words, but from a design thinking standpoint, create new opportunities to expand on just those three words, right? But what three words do you want today's audience to leave our episode with regards to underscoring AI to address adult and student modalities in the AC stage of education? What three words would provide intentionally to build capabilities and learning styles so that it becomes a complementary context with using AI in our learning organizations today and moving forward?
So I think my first one, and this is probably one of my biggest core values, is freedom.
Yeah.
And I think freedom is often used just sometimes politically, like, oh, I get to vote, or I get to, like, you know, they have choices and things like that. It's freedom has so many layers. It's freedom of time, freedom of space, freedom of thinking. There's so many different things that accompany freedom, and also looking at freedom from an equity lens, like the freedom of every single human being. It's, you know, traditionally it's just been human against human. It's now human versus AI. You've got a third entity in the mix. And when humans themselves are not aligned, it's like, even, you know, when, like, a family, for example, like if you, or a friend, like if you're not aligned and you're not on the same page, you don't have each other's backs, there's an opening now for a third party to come in and cause disruption and cause chaos in a way that you couldn't even have imagined, because you're weak. Humans are so weak right now. So, so, so weak right now. And so I think looking at how we somehow recover from this, like, colonial mindset, from all these, like it shocks me to think that we have been brainwashed in such a way that we can look at some people and think one thing and look at other people and look another way. It is truly, I mean, forget any political view you hold. The idea that somebody has done that to you is should frighten you. And so now that there's that opening for AI, what does that possibly mean for you? And we're so programmed to think it would never be me. And I think we're going to be really shocked to see what happens in this next decade if, like, humans don't get it together. So that's my first one, is freedom on so many different levels. My second one is, to balance that out, optimism. I think there's so much reason for hope. I think, you know, when I look at this next generation, I am not a big TikTok user, but I lately, because it just seems to be the best source of news, have been scrolling TikTok, and I am absolutely blown away by how people are sharing perspective, how people are shifting perspective, how people are building community, how people are supporting each other, how people are fundraising. There are just all these different things. And the dialogue that's taking place, that's not just young people, it's them being able to engage multiple generations as well, is one of the most beautiful things that has given me optimism in one of the darkest times of, I think, like, our modern human history. And so that would be my second one, is there's so much to be hopeful for, and there are so many people you can align with as you advance whatever cause it is that you're looking for. And then the third one, let's see, so freedom, optimism, and freedom, optimism, third word. I mean, I think right now, like,
and to my audience, you will never see Dr. Kid Y stumped like this. So we got it on video right here.
Yeah, it's so hard. And I think right now, I think just because of, like I said, like, this moment in time, I would say the third one, but it might echo the first one, but it goes back to how important it is humanity.
Absolutely.
Like, if you don't figure out, like, what that means, like, there's so many terms we use so generically, humanity, creativity. If you don't actually define what these mean, and you don't find a way to allow it mean the same thing for everyone, that, and I think I say that because that's what scares me the most. I know a lot of people care about privacy and data and, like, hallucinations. This is actually the other thing. It is absolutely wild to me. And people looking back on our time are going to laugh at us. This is a society that criticized AI, bias in AI, and completely neglected to address the bias in humans, but thought the bias in AI could be solved without addressing the bias in humans. People are going to laugh at us when they look back at our posts and our writings and what the dialogue we were engaging in. And so I would just say, like, that humanity piece is so essential, because you can never have all these other things that you worry about can never be solved for if, one, we don't believe in it for everybody, and number two, we don't fix that problem in the human first, because the human is programming, at least for now, the human is programming the AI. Who knows what that looks like in the future? But if humanity is not where it needs to be, how can you expect anything else to come about as a result that is going to be an equitable and sustainable solution that moves everybody forward? I don't see that. I don't understand how that happens.
Amen, Saba. I tell you, the humans are programming the AI, and we have to deal with the values and the ethics of us as a society to be able to ensure that we are eliminating biases and grounding our values, even when we're designing on these specific models that are rooted in algorithms. Freedom, optimism, and humanity. Dr. Kidwai, thank you so much. So now, for my listeners who want to get in contact with you, Saba, right? Want to be a part of your organization, Designing Schools, want to reach out to you, your books that you have or that you've written, how would they be able to obtain them? Information, email, even to pertaining to Designing Schools, your organization?
I mean, I would say it's like choose your own adventure. Go to designingschools.org and choose your own adventure. You can go to Instagram, LinkedIn, email, blog, podcast, whatever you enjoy.
Dr. Kidwai, thank you so much for being a guest on Voices for Excellence. Anytime you're on the East Coast, please remember to bring the weather back, literally, to my listeners. When I saw Dr. Kidwai in New York City, it was probably one of the last nice days of the year. And it was literally a Southern California day. I saw Saba. I'm like, you brought the weather with you, man. We're not going to see this for a while. And guess what? We haven't seen it for a while. But Saba, thank you so much for coming on VFE. It means the world to have your intellect, your expertise, and your acumen bestowed upon us as well as my listeners.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.